House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 9th, 2015. There's no work session to introduce committee measures today. The first item on the agenda we're going to go to today is an open informational on Oregon Judicial Department by Chief Justice Ballmer. Thank you, Chief, for taking the time to come over.
Well, thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the committee. We really appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk a little bit about the Oregon Judicial Branch. We have not done this in prior years. We've usually made a very detailed presentation to Ways and Means Committee, our subcommittee on public safety, as some of you know. And we appreciate coming before the House Judiciary Committee to talk a little bit about what the Oregon Judicial Department does. And it's 3 o'clock on Monday afternoon. This is sort of a low blood sugar time of day, so I'm going to try and move through these things fairly quickly. Thank you, Vice Chair Williamson. I may need some of that candy. Feel free to interrupt me with questions at any point. I want to talk a little bit about what the state courts do, about how the Oregon Judicial Department will appear before you this session, what you can expect from us. And then the chair asked me to review briefly the presentation that we made to some of you during the legislative trainings last month. And I'll do that quickly because I know that some of you were there. I should also introduce Phil Lemon, who is here and who works with the legislature with our state court administrator, Kingsley Click, on a number of issues, and Josh Nasby in the back. Wave Josh. And Bruce Miller, you'll also see our state court administrator, Kingsley Click, will also be over here from time to time. You know, the basics, three branches of government, right? We'll start at the very beginning. We were actually all called departments in the Oregon Constitution because that's what we were called when the Constitution was written in 1857 and adopted in 1859, and then the legislature referred a constitutional amendment to the voters in 2012, and we were renamed branches. So we now are called the judicial branch, the executive branch, and the legislative branch. So the judicial branch then includes the state courts, which is the Oregon Judicial Department, the Office of Public Defense Services. That's the commission that takes care of indigent defense work. And the state spends a lot of money, as is appropriate, for providing counsel for people accused of criminal violations who can't afford their own lawyers. And you'll hear from the Public Defense Services Commission. And then there's the Judicial Fitness and Disability Commission, which is a special ethics commission for judges that applies and interprets the Code of Judicial Conduct. So courts are a third branch. We resolve disputes of all kind, as you know, criminal, civil, family law, many others. And we also act as a constitutional check and balance to the other branches of government. Are the executive and legislative branches acting within the limits of their constitutional and statutory authority? So this is the way we're structured. We have a Supreme Court of 7 judges. We have a Court of Appeals of 13. There was a third panel added 2 years ago, by the legislature. We really appreciate that. That's one of the hardest working intermediate appellate courts in the country. And then we have circuit courts all around the state. We have 36 counties, and we have a circuit court in every county. Those are organized into 27 judicial districts. In the rural areas, we have more than one county within a judicial district. So we have about 200 independently elected judges. In addition to the circuit courts, Court of Appeals, and Supreme Court that hear civil and criminal cases of all kinds, we have the tax court that has a special jurisdiction, and its appeals from the tax court go directly to the Supreme Court. We also have about 1,800 full-time employees. Some of them are over in the Justice Building across the street. That's our central staff. But we also have many employees in the 36 counties where we operate courts. Now, I know you're going to be hearing from the local court judges today, so let me just say one or two things about them. OJD has very limited authority over justice or municipal courts. Not to say we should have more, but we don't. I don't supervise, the state court administrator doesn't supervise the justice and municipal courts. Their cases can be appealed to the circuit courts or to the Court of Appeals, and Oregon's Code of Judicial Conduct applies to state judges, county judges, and justices of the peace, but not to municipal court judges. So the local courts are part of the Oregon court system, but they're not part of the state court system that I'm responsible for as Chief Justice. One comment, because we don't have a separate slide on it, is about how our judges are selected. I think, as most of you know, we are elected. We are nonpartisan. If a judge retires before the end of his or her term, the governor gets to appoint a replacement, and then that person has to run at the next general election. The governor gets to fill those vacancies. We all serve six-year terms, and all 200 judges are selected in that way. The Oregon Judicial Department administrative structure, this is not the court part of it. You saw the court part in the earlier slide. This is our administrative side, where I, as the Chief Justice, supervise the state court administrator. We have our own internal auditor off to the right there. And off to the left, I know it's a little too small to read, but that is our temporary e-court implementation program. And I think, as most of you know, and I'm happy to talk about it, actually, I'm very happy to talk about it anytime you want. We have one of the tech projects in the state that is working right now. We are in the process of implementing eCourt. We took Multnomah County, our biggest county, live in May. We took Marion County and several smaller counties live in March or in December. And we're on a fairly aggressive but doable schedule that will lead to the completion of implementation in June of 2016. So this biennium, we're going to be done implementing Oregon eCourt.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, excuse me. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I just because I'm fascinated by that, the eCourt, would you mind just give me like maybe a typical way you use eCourt?
eCourt is a combination of an electronic case management system. All the documents are electronic. Now, they're all scanned. If they come in electronically, they just come right in the system. If they came in on paper, they were scanned. One of the difficulties of eCourt, or one of the challenges, has been converting all of our existing cases all on paper. We used to process 50 million pieces of paper a year, 50 million a year. And we've cut that down because of eCourt, and we're going to cut it way down. But so if the new filing comes in now, you would not file it if you're a lawyer in a county that's gone to eCourt. You wouldn't send your messenger down or send it in the mail. You would push a button, you'd type up your document, convert it into a PDF, and file it electronically. When the judge is there hearing, a sentencing, taking a plea, the judge will have a screen there where he will have on the screen all the documents that relate to this, the indictment, if there was a pre-sentencing report of some kind, and he will push the buttons with the assistance of a bailiff or a clerk, and after questioning the defendant, do you understand the basis for this plea you're giving? Have you had a chance to consult with your attorney? Do you understand this is going to mean X months in prison for you? And the document will be immediately printed from the screen. So it's electronic filing. It is electronic case management. It is a person-based system where we can say, oh, it's Mr. Post. Now, does Mr. Post have anything else? Excuse me. Let's say Mr. Lemon, who's now in court in Marion County. Does he have anything in Polk County? Yeah. Well, in the old days, we couldn't check that very easily. Now we have a person-based system, and we will be able to, from around the state, figure out whether he has other pending charges, whether perhaps he has an issue with DHS or He's been an incompetent parent, and one of his kids is under the supervision of DHS. We can pull all that together, which is very important given the mobility in our society. It also allows e-payments, so people can go on. This is stuff that people expect in every other aspect of their life. You don't expect to have to go down to Pacific Power and give them your check and get it stamped and all that. You expect to be able to go online and either through electronic banking, if you want to, or people can send their checks in by mail too. But we are now processing a very large number of our payments of fines and penalties through e-payment. So it's a sort of set of services we are rolling out in, right now we're doing two or three judicial districts at a time. So that's short version.
Wow.
And I'd love to talk to you about how we structured this to try and keep senior management. When I became Chief Justice, I said, isn't that something I can delegate? I don't have to do this, do I? And I was told, no, you cannot delegate this. You have to head what's called the Executive Sponsors Committee of four high-level people who are going to be the ultimately responsible for the decisions that get made for E-Court. And we have a very good team. And what we're actually doing now is starting to transition to our post-implementation world, which doesn't mean our E-Court costs are going to go away. Our implementation costs will go away. But like every computer system, we have to get updates. We have to fix bugs. We have to put in new equipment from time to time. We have to continue training. But this has been a project that, after a detour, which my predecessor helped correct us from some years ago, we started down a path that was not a very good path. We regrouped, and we started implementation in 2012, and we are now more than halfway to having brought this to the whole state. So,
great, thank you.
I could go on for a long time. We can talk offline if you'd like to.
Well, I'm just nerdy enough that I like that stuff.
Yeah. So here, this is our state court administrator's office. So our e-court team, which led to that discussion. And then we have, these are the things you might expect in any administrative structure that we do centrally: finances, HR, our IT group, our business and financial services. One thing I will also mention is a resource that is available to the committee, of course, and all members of the legislature, is the State of Oregon Law Library. And we have a very good librarian and library there. We provide legal research resources to the Office of Legal Counsel, but we're also happy to provide assistance to your staff, committee, or personal, if you ever need that. Feel free to call us. This is not the Ways and Means Committee, I know, but let me just tell you a little bit about our budget. We're less than 3% of the state general fund, and when you see our budget, it's not a huge number, but it does include a lot of things that don't go directly into our provision of services. We are a pass-through, for example, to the money going out to Union County to help rebuild a new courthouse out there, to Jefferson County, where the state is helping Jefferson County build a new courthouse, and to Multnomah County, where we're working on a new courthouse now. Money comes through us as a pass-through and goes out to legal aid, to mediation services, and other important uses. Most of our budget is for trial court operations, and most of our budget is for people. So although you'll see those of us who are mostly in Salem, you'll probably also see our folks from around the state. And I'll talk to you a little bit about our policy for judges and staff speaking to a committee. And if you want to get in touch with any of them, you're free to do so, obviously, and we can also facilitate that. But most of our people are spread around the state, making sure that we are able to provide access to courts on a full-time basis in every corner of the state. We also collect them a lot of money. We collected $277 million dollars in fines and fees in 2013. We don't get to keep most of that. I'm not sure we get to keep any of it. It comes into the general fund, and some of it goes back out to us. But we are a big generator of revenue for the state. My priorities this biennium is first of all, to maintain our current service level. As you may know, in the past, we actually were closed on Fridays for a number of years, not every Friday, but a number of Fridays because of budget cuts. And the 2013 legislature gave us enough money to open up the courts every day. The courts really need to be open every business day. If somebody who's threatened with domestic violence needs to get a restraining order, if Nike needs to get a restraining order against employees who are leaving for Adidas and taking a lot of ideas that are in progress, as happened allegedly, then they file it in state court. But that's why the courts need to be open. If there are children who are threatened and the state needs to come in quickly and do what's needed to protect them, we need to provide courts that are available for them. So we did get enough money to open up the courts 5 days a week. We do not have all our courts open and fully operating and answering their phones 7 or 8 hours a day because we still have not recovered from all the cuts that we took during the recession. The co-chair's budget framework does give us our current service level budget, and we're very appreciative for that. The next thing my next priority really is finishing e-court funding, which will require one more round of bond funding, and as I mentioned, training and maintenance that will go on. Judicial compensation, that's a discussion probably for another day. We are, our circuit judges are 49th out of 50 in the latest state survey. Our Court of Appeals judges are 37th, but that's because there are only 38 states that have intermediate courts of appeals. So that there's a reason for that anomaly. And we also are going to continue to discuss with the legislature help for the counties that are trying to replace unsafe and unsecure courthouses. That's briefly what we'll be looking at with ways and means in this legislative session. We have undertaken we've taken a number of steps to increase efficiency. E-court, I mentioned e-filing, online document access. Representative Post, I didn't mention the fact that lawyers and government users, and we're trying to roll this out to individuals too with appropriate safeguards for privacy, can get online access to all these documents that are in the court files. So we're already hearing from, for example, district attorneys saying, gosh, I didn't have to go around looking for that file because I could go on your system and find a copy of the indictment and the motion to suppress that was filed and the affidavit filed by the police officer and all those things. So that is turning out to be a real increase in efficiency for a lot of folks. The recession is still fresh in our minds. So we lost 17% of our staff after the recession started in 2009. And we have really two components of our work, people and paper. So we lost 17% of our people, but we still had our 50 million pieces of paper. And that makes a real challenge because our job is to get the right document into the right file at the right time with the right information. And when we have fewer people, there's delays, and we're also more likely to make a mistake. And the fact is, the faster we work, the more mistakes we make, unless we're using technology wisely. And we really can't afford to make very many mistakes. We can't afford to let the wrong person out of jail or to enter a judgment against somebody who ought not to have a judgment entered against them. We need to do stuff right. People expect us to be right, not just 90% of the time or 95%, but 99.9% of the time. And we really try and do that. We've undertaken a number of internal management steps to increase efficiency. We have a docket management initiative that is trying to pull together the best thinking from around the country about how to manage our cases appropriately, how to get the cases decided quickly, get them to issue, get them done. If they're going to settle, let's get them settled, criminal or civil. We want to give people their day in court. Due process is probably the most important thing we have to offer to people. You can come to court and you will be treated fairly. And it doesn't matter your skin color or your religion or your party. This is equal justice under the law is what the courts are all about, and we will give you due process. But we also want to, and our Constitution requires us to, decide cases without delay, and we're trying to do that. And actually, we would do pretty well compared to national statistics. Let's go on to the next slide. We'll pick this up a little bit. Now, the legislature, judges and staff will testify. The only thing that I ask them is to tell you whether they're representing OJD or themselves. When you have one of your colleagues testifies on a bill, you know they're speaking for themselves or constituents and not for the legislature as a whole. Sometimes we will have folks over here who are speaking on behalf of OJD, Phil or Josh or Kingsley Click or myself. Oftentimes, you may ask a legislator to come, or a judge to come from your district and talk about how a particular juvenile or family law matter plays out in your state, in your county, in your circuit court. And we're happy to have them do that. I just ask them to tell you who they're representing. So if you'd like to have a judge give you some information on how something works in one of your areas, or there's a particular issue that you have, we'll try and find you the right person. Feel free to contact them directly or contact me or Phil Lemon, and we'll put you in touch with one of the judges in your area. I'd also invite you to visit our circuit courts. All of you have one or more circuit courts within the territory that you represent, and these folks are a wealth of knowledge about I see Representative Olson smiling there. He's a lot of you folks who've been around for a while know that we have a terrific group of circuit court judges, trial court administrators, they're the top administrative person within each circuit court, and we're happy to have them provide information that you'd find useful to in your work here. So legislative actions affecting the courts, this is what you do. You establish the crimes, the penalties, the procedures. You define rights of action, civil procedures. And in fact, you often establish docket priorities and timelines. You sometimes tell us, we don't always like this, but we effectuate the legislative policy. You say decide these land use cases within 90 days, and we try and do that. You say, give these cases priority, and we do that. Now, if you say to about every set of cases, give these cases priority, then it's a little harder to do. But the legislature takes a lot of actions that direct how we do our work. You require the court locations, and you set the number of judges. You set court fees. Sometimes you give us a little discretion on things like fees or penalties. You may set a range of penalties that the judge can impose in a particular criminal case. You set judicial salaries. As most of you know, our salaries are in statute. There's no automatic COLA. There's no adjustment. It takes a statute passed by both houses, signed by the governor, to change our salaries, for better or worse. And you set our budget. Some of the items are non-reducible. You can't reduce salaries during the term of a judge's office, but you have a lot of control over our budget generally. So very briefly, Representative Olson. Oh, sorry. Yeah, Representative Olson, sorry.
Justice, that sounds like a pitch. So let's
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, we're working
Representative Olson, he'll make that pitch later in Ways and Means.
Okay. We'll make that pitch to Ways and Means, yeah. I understand which committee this is, but again, Chair Barker, I appreciate the opportunity to come, and I will try and keep my comments within the range of things that this committee has authority over.
You're doing right. We have a compensation bill in this committee.
Okay.
We're there.
You're there. So the Supreme Court, and again, for some of you, this is old hat, and I'm always a little leery about doing these presentations because many of you have been on this committee for a long time. You have a very deep understanding. For some of you, this is a little newer. But the Supreme Court has discretionary review of Court of Appeals decisions. We get about 1,000 requests to review Court of Appeals decisions every year, and we allow 60 or 70 of those. So it's like, you know, not dissimilar from the U.S. Supreme Court. We allow 6 or 7% of the petitions that come to us. And then the legislature has directed that certain cases come directly to the Supreme Court, skipping the Court of Appeals, like death penalty, tax court, our favorite ballot titles. They come directly to us. Prison siting disputes, decisions of the Energy Facility Siting Commission. If anybody knows anything about that, I've actually written an opinion about the Energy Facility Siting Commission or Council. So certain direct review cases come direct to the Supreme Court. And then we still have these old English writs, you can tell by their Latin names, habeas corpus, mandamus, quo warranto. And people do file these, and sometimes we allow them. If somebody is being wrongly held in jail, so they can file a habeas corpus petition. And we get those, and if we determine that they've been, it looks like they're being wrongly held, we will often respond and hear their argument. The Court of Appeals gets appeals from circuit court cases, so they do criminal, civil, domestic relations, juvenile. They also get appeals from state agency actions, and they are also asked to review quite often state agency rules. So if a state agency, if the Environmental Quality Commission or the Bureau of Labor and Industries adopts rules and some party thinks that those rules are not consistent with the legislative authority that allows them to make rules, for example, you're the head of BOLI, are you making rules in an area that you really don't have any authority over? People may challenge those, and those go right to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals also hears certain appeals from local government actions. And then we have the tax court, which, as I mentioned, hears all sorts of tax cases. And then those are appealed directly to the Supreme Court. This is a little map that shows you where our judicial districts are, we can, this is all in the blue book, and most of you know this anyhow, but this shows our 27 districts and the county or counties that are included within those districts. We are very fortunate to have a terrific trial bench. If I had my druthers, I might have 10 or 15 judicial districts, frankly, than 27. I'm not sure we need that many anymore, but that's where we have been historically, and we don't have a proposal in to change that. The circuit courts are our general jurisdiction courts. That means that they hear essentially all cases under Oregon law, violations of state criminal and civil laws. Certain federal matters can show up in circuit court. On the public safety side, everybody is aware of these, the felonies and misdemeanors, the violations, the juvenile delinquency, the protective orders, stalking orders, and domestic violence concerns. We also deal a lot, more than we would like to, with families in crisis. We have lots of dependency cases, allegations of child abuse and neglect. We have child support orders, and we have domestic relations. In many of these cases, as you may know, for example, domestic relations in particular, people don't have lawyers. They can't afford lawyers, or they think they can do it themselves. One of the challenges of operating a state court system these days is dealing with all the self-represented folks. We also sort of less recognized, but is our role in economic development. For people to establish and collect debts, you have to go to court. It's one of the things about the United States that most people don't think about until you travel to someplace like Russia or China and realize that one of the problems is the court systems don't work, and therefore people don't always pay their debts. because they think that, and in off cases, oftentimes it's true, that the court system is corrupt or is going to take too long. We pride ourselves in having a court system where individuals and businesses can establish debts that are owed and collect on them. We handle foreclosures. We interpret private contracts. We handle personal injury, whether it's a slip and fall or a medical malpractice case or a big asbestosis dispute involving lots and lots of plaintiffs. We have consumer protection and landlord-tenant matters, and we have a whole host of civil commitment, post-conviction, probate, guardianship and conservatorship proceedings. And one of the things we're seeing, just you may see some of this in bills that come before you, but an increasing area of concern to us and of work for us is elder issues. More and more, the person who has to be under guardianship is not somebody under 18, it's somebody over 85. And it's one thing to say, okay, you're not an adult, you have to have a guardian if you're under 18. It's very tough to take somebody who was a very successful, competent adult and say, we're going to put you under guardianship now because you're not competent all the time and somebody is taking your money, taking advantage of you, and those are turning out to be very difficult cases for the courts, and we're seeing more and more of them. You know, for the reasons that I just have gone through, we often say that courts are at the core because a lot of the things that are of concern in our society, whether it's crimes and violations or kids at risk, economic disputes or family relations, to get from the problem to a solution, the sentences, the safe and stable homes, a judgment that allows you to enforce your economic rights, protection for family members, you have to go through the courts. We are, in many respects, a social service agency, frankly. We do that on the family law side. We are a public safety agency because of all the criminal work we do. We are an economic development agency because having a swift and effective way of resolving business disputes and allowing folks to enforce their economic rights is really important to the business community. So we say courts are at the core of many of these issues that are important in our society right now. So I was going to turn briefly to just a quick recap of the session that we did in January about interpretation, about the Constitution and the statutes. But if there are questions about the Oregon Judicial Department, Oregon Judicial Branch, I'd be happy to answer those.
I appreciate your earlier information about how to write a law and what's required. We just saw another example the other day of the guy taking pictures of somebody's skirt, and it wasn't a crime because it wasn't written in plain English language. I was able to, thanks to the information you've given us, I was asked by a TV station about that, you know, kind of like, what do you think of the judge's decision? I had to say the judge did exactly the right thing because that's what the law said.
And right.
So I like that. I would like to ask you, you certainly don't need to come up with an answer today, but something to think about. There's a bill that's going to require grand juries to be recorded, and since the grand juries belong to the courts, if you would consider what that might cost, and I think it would, my opinion is, it's going to be fairly expensive because in order to have adequate recording equipment to get a good review and then storage and all that. So that's just something that's coming down the pike, and I expect that there will be a bill to do that. So.
Right. We are of that aware of that bill, and we haven't analyzed it in detail, but it certainly would have some direct and indirect cost. You know, one of the things I didn't say, Chair Barker, and I know you know this better than most people, that one of the reasons we don't take positions on these policy bills for the most part is that's your choice. That's a legislative choice. We don't think it's appropriate to weigh in. We will oftentimes come over here and talk about how something would work, and we often provide a fiscal if it would have a fiscal impact on the courts, and we will often provide technical suggestions about how a bill might be that effectuates a policy choice that you're interested in, how that could best be done. But you folks make those decisions. And I won't comment on that case because who knows whether it's coming up or not, the case about the upskirting. I'd never heard of upskirting myself. But we take an oath to decide our cases consistently with the state and federal statutes and constitutions, and that's what we try to do. We're nonpartisan and non-policy oriented. But we nevertheless want to help you effectuate your policy choices, and so that's why we appear here as often as we do.
And so. Again, I know you don't want to comment on that case in case it comes up, but we have a bill to fix it, so I don't expect that to be coming up. But in the other, I wasn't asking you like opinion. I just wanted to kind of give you a heads up, and so you could have somebody give some thought to how that recording might be done.
Right.
I
mean,
it obviously will cost something, and we may be able to pay for it somewhere out of something else, but just so that you're aware of that.
Yeah, appreciate that.
Anybody else have any comments? Thank you very much, Justice. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Do you want to talk about this other material or no?
I'm sorry, yeah.
Oh, no. No. It's up to you.
No, please.
Chair Barker's really subtle.
Okay, and I know some of you were at the session that we did earlier, and I will just spend just a couple seconds on this. So the Oregon Constitution, right, was adopted by the people in 1857, went into effect, as I said, in 1859. And we could put up our other slide of the three branches, but as you know, the legislature creates the laws, the executive executes the laws, and we interpret and enforce the laws. We have in our Constitution has a particular specific provision, unlike the federal Constitution, that says separation of powers. We have the separation of powers. You can't unduly interfere with another branch's powers. So the role of the legislature is shared with the people because since the early 1900s, the people have the initiative power to make statutes and to change the Constitution. The legislature has plenary power. It means you can legislate on anything you want to, subject to constitutional limitations. So the limits are federal constitution and laws, not all federal laws, only, and this gets to be a very complicated and sort of contentious issue, where the federal law really preempts the state law, and they don't in very many areas. If you wanted to regulate nuclear submarines, I can guarantee you that the federal courts are going to say, no, the state of Oregon can't do much regulating of nuclear submarines, although you probably could if they're approaching the Columbia River. The Oregon Constitution has limits on legislative authority, procedural limits such as how you go about making laws. They have to be read three times. Revenue bills have to start in the House. You need a three-fifths majority, and they have to contain only one subject. We interpret that very broadly. The only bill I can remember that the court threw out, this is before my time, because it the subject, which was in that bill was general government, was too broad. And that bill included salmon habitat restoration and TriMet and mass transit and some other tax exemption, and probably a criminal proceeding, too. And the court said, look, we give the legislature a lot of discretion in deciding what's a single subject. Taxes can be a single subject. Criminal law can be a single subject. General government cannot be a single subject because that would essentially read that requirement out of the Constitution. And then there are some subject matter limitations. We have a free exercise provision in our Constitution. We have a free speech provision. We have a right to bear arms provision. We also have an equal privileges and immunities provision, and there are constitutional limits on what courts or what the legislature can do. So we determine and enforce the meaning of the Constitution.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yes.
Representative, can I ask you a
question?
I'm not sure this is a proper question, but let me try. The Constitution says that the legislature can make their own rules. To what extent does that, what's the relationship between statutes and the rules of the legislature? I mean, I'm thinking about it in a particular context, but which I don't want to mention. But.
Yeah, well, Representative Green, like that's a very interesting issue, and we actually mentioned it in a fairly recent opinion about protesting on the Capitol steps, and the legislature has a committee that gets to make rules about how the Capitol is used. Now, there are certain limitations on those things, but in terms of your own operating rules, the way your caucuses operate, or the way who gets to speak on the floor of the House or the Senate, there are a number of rules like that that are now. Are those the kind of rules you're yes. thinking about?
Can I follow up?
Yes, you can.
Let's go to that example of. I mean, could there be a statute that would say the legislature cannot restrict these kinds of demonstrations on the steps of the Capitol?
You know, that's an issue that might come before us, and I'd be hesitant to give an opinion about that beforehand. But that's an interesting question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Green, like, are you done?
No, this is going to go on.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'll yield the floor to you, though.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, another question, as long as we're rolling in hypothetical. So, Oregon Constitution famously does not have a due process clause, right? Without due process, you know, we won't. I'm wondering if that's something. Do you actually wrestle with that very often? We seem to have a more robust privileges and immunities clause than other states, but in practice, do you ever run into outcomes you think that would be different because of our lack of due process clause?
Or do you get Representative Bart, that's a good question. Just for those of you who have not thought a lot about the Oregon Constitution, I know most of you have one way or another. But there's a famous and important provision in the federal Constitution, which is in the Fifth Amendment and in the 14th Amendment, that says that the government can't deprive anyone of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And the Oregon Constitution does not contain that particular provision. Now, the fact is the federal Constitution does, and the federal Constitution applies to us. So there certainly are some cases, Representative Barton, where we would say it's unclear, for example, whether this proceeding, this trial proceeding, and what the judge cut off the defense lawyer from making any sort of argument, sort of a due process mm-hmm. type of problem. And we might say, this is probably covered by your right to counsel and right to a criminal jury trial in the Oregon Constitution. But even if it wasn't, mm-hmm. it is protected by the due process clause of the federal Constitution, and say that it was problematic for that reason. So we sort of default to the federal Constitution on that. But in terms of our general approach, which is to look at the Oregon Constitution first, before we look at whether there's any violation of the federal Constitution, if we had a due process clause, there certainly are some areas of the law where it clearly covers things that we would certainly try to get to under the Privileges and Immunities Clause or your right to a jury trial, for example.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Best I could come up with in 30 seconds.
Thank you.
So as I said, we don't second-guess policy choices made by the legislature, but we may invalidate laws if they're passed in violation of procedural, the single subject requirement, or substantive limitations if you passed a law that simply said you cannot express negative views about the governor. We would say, no, you can't do that. We would say that is unconstitutional. Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution is a very broad free speech provision. Okay, statutory interpretation. We interpret laws and apply them. And one of the things we have to do is to interpret sometimes ambiguous language. And we resolve conflicts between statutes. How do we do that? How do we interpret statutes? There are really two sets of rules. Actually, in the Oregon Revised Statutes, you have told us how you want us to interpret statutes. You've said consider all the words. Don't omit any words that have been included in the statute. Don't put any words that were not included. And you've said, you've given us some other specific directions. These are things that we would do anyhow, but it certainly doesn't hurt to have them in statute. You've said if there's a general and a specific statute, apply the more specific one if they're in conflict. For example, in tort cases where somebody is suing for injury caused by another person, we have a statute of limitations. If this happened 6 years ago, or 3 or 4 years ago, or certainly 10 or 12 years ago, it's too late. You can't sue over that. We need you to bring your claim sooner. But you also, in a statute, have said in sex abuse cases, the statute of limitations is extended. And so for sex abuse cases, we apply the longer statute, even though there's arguably a conflict between those two statute of limitations. And then we have court-made rules that have developed over time. This comes out of our English common law tradition. And basically, the most important thing we look at are the words that the legislature used. And the words have to match your intent. Some years ago, there was a case about whether certain pay for overtime should apply to managers. And the intent in the legislative history was to deal with a problem that didn't involve managers. It involved some people that probably should have gotten overtime but hadn't. But the way the legislature wrote the bill, it applied to a whole bunch of people, including managers. And our courts, I was in the Attorney General's office defending that case and losing, because the courts said, you wrote this in a way that covers management employees. And the courts interpreted it that way, and that's the way it happened. So it's not enough to sort of, in a committee hearing, say, well, what we're intending here is to cover the attorney or employees in this classification if you have written it in a way that covers a whole bunch of other employees. So it is very important to use words that that match the intent. And if the words are sort of ambiguous, we can understand, if we can reach an interpretation that is consistent with the legislative intent as expressed in committee hearings or on the floor, we will do that. But if the words aren't broad enough to get to the intent you want, then we simply can't do that. Let me give you one other example, and one suggestion is to define the terms you use. I used this suggestion when I spoke to you before. The identity theft, right? Identity theft is using the identity of another person to deceive a third person for purposes of personal advantage. Well, suppose somebody uses a fictitious name. Is that identity theft? Well, that would be a really interesting question. The courts would, we could spend a lot of time thinking about that and scratch our heads. What did they mean? Were they just trying to prevent people from being ripped off and their credit card information being stolen? Or were they trying to prevent deception of a police officer or a bank teller or somebody in a store? And in fact, the legislature defined the word another person and defined it to include fictitious persons. So if I come up with a fake driver's license that says Robin Hood or something, even though that's not the name of another person who might have a driver's license in Oregon, it is the name of a fictitious person, and if I'm using that to personal advantage, that would be considered identity theft. And we know that because the legislature defined the term. So if you have a particular word that is problematic or important in a statute that you're working on, think about using a particular definition that will cover what you want. So legislative history, we often talk about. It's not a substitute for clear drafting, but basically we do look to what legislators said in committee. We look to the staff summaries. We look to floor statements. Floor statements are often particularly helpful because everybody is presumed to have heard it. You have a question and answer. You've got somebody that was carrying the bill. So oftentimes that helps us understand exactly what the legislature meant. And as I said, that is important. It can't get us to where you want to go if the words of the statute don't get you there. And the words of the statute are the most important thing, because that is the one thing that we know 16 people in the Senate and 31 in the House and the governor all agreed to. So that's sort of the gold standard. But we do legislative history, and we use legislative history to help us understand what you meant if we have any questions about it. So just to summarize, you have broad lawmaking power subject to some procedural and substantive limits in the Constitution. We determine the meaning of the statutes you pass, and you can help us do what you want to do, because that's our goal. What did the legislature intend? Writing clear statutes, working with legislative counsel to articulate what you intend to cover, defining the terms, and making clear legislative history. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop, and thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you for your time. Anybody have any? Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Parker.
Next. Can we get CLE credit for that?
Just
yeah.
CLE credit.
Oh. I'll pass that assignment.
Really? I was joking, but that would be great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Doesn't serving on this committee give you CLE credit?
For us.
A little bit.
It does.
Close the informational meeting on the Oregon Judicial Department. Open one on the Municipal Courts and Justice of the Peace. Honorable Carl A. Myers, or A. Carl Myers, I should say. And Judge Limehouse, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you just heard from the Chief Justice about the state court system. Well, as Paul Harvey used to say, now for the rest of the story. For your record, I am Carl Myers. Pardon?
That's a commercial.
He said that. And he started out his second segment with that, too. Any event, my name is Carl Myers. I am a municipal court judge. I am the presiding judge in the city of Kaiser, just to your north. I also am the presiding judge in the city of Jefferson, a small town just south of here. But you'll be seeing me in front of you from time to time, because I do serve as the government relations consultant for the Oregon Municipal Judges Association, the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association. We're here today to fill in the other portion of the justice system, that being the municipal courts and the justice courts. I should ask, how many of you have been in a voluntarily visited a municipal court or a justice court? I would certainly suggest that you take some time. Almost all of you have a justice court in your district. Those of you in Multnomah County have neither justice courts or municipal courts because of that strange situation up there. I shouldn't say strange, but different situation up there. But I certainly encourage you to visit your local courts, as I call them, to find out what goes down at the local level, because in most cases we are the courts where most of your constituents first and only appear in front of a courthouse. I call them local courts. You may have heard them in the past being referred to as special courts or specialty courts. That term is now refers to mental health courts, veteran courts, drug courts, and the like. We have also been referred to as limited jurisdiction courts. I'm not sure that's correct or appropriate, but we certainly are local courts because our bosses, our finances all are from the local level. I want to, before we get into the types of courts, I want to make one statement. We are another trial court level. We are not in competition with the state courts. In fact, I like to think we work hand in hand to make a better justice system in the state of Oregon. Faster, less expensive in some cases, but certainly we try to work hand in hand with the Chief Justice, the appellate courts, and the trial courts around the state to handle the cases that either they can't handle or are more appropriately handled at the local level. With that, Judge Judd Lemhaus is here. He's going to be talking a little bit about the justice courts, and then we'll talk some about the municipal courts, and then open it up to questions after that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Chad Lemhaus, Justice of the Peace for Linn County. As Justice of the Peace, I also exercise municipal court jurisdiction for eight small cities within the Linn County, two of which have freestanding municipal courts over which I preside as judge, and the other six of which have assigned their municipal court jurisdiction to the Justice of the Peace Court. Justices of the Peace are the oldest and longest-serving judges in the state of Oregon, having our service commence well before Oregon was an organized state or territory. Between the years 1818 and 1846, Oregon was jointly administered by both Great Britain and the United States, and the first justices of the peace were actually came to the Oregon country by a reason of an act of Parliament. Justices of the peace under American auspices were actually, the first one was actually created by a group of Methodist missionaries that met in 1837 and appointed one of their members as a Justice of the Peace, and we've been serving Oregon ever since. After having been the most numerous judges for many years, we are now the least numerous class of judges other than the appellate courts. There are 24 Justices of the Peace and 20 appellate court judges. The 24 justices of the peace are all elected for six-year terms. We're constitutional judges, as are circuit court judges. We're elected by the electors within our Justice of the Peace district. We have countywide jurisdiction over all offenses that are committed within the county except for the trial of felonies. We have a civil jurisdiction that includes the recovery of property or damages where the limit is $10,000. Anything $10,000 or less can be litigated in a Justice of the Peace Court. We also exercise what's known as FED jurisdiction or landlord-tenant jurisdiction, regardless of the value of the property that's at issue in the right to possession case. We do a lot of different kinds of things in a lot of different places. Most of our courts sit in rural areas because we are by law, except for eight counties, Tillamook County in western Oregon and seven counties in eastern Oregon. We're prevented from holding court in any city in which the circuit court also holds regular sessions. And so we're typically found someplace else than the county seat. Oregon Law Review did a survey pursuant to a request from the governor's office some years ago. 1973 actually was the year that was surveyed. And I've attached a document in the group of papers that I've submitted for your review that describes the caseload of the 48 justices of peace that handled cases in Oregon in 1973 and compares that with the 24 justices of the peace that handled the similar cases in 2014. One of the interesting things you might note is that the number, or the, I should say, the percentage of the volume of traffic cases hasn't changed very much. We're still doing a lot of traffic cases. Did about 83% or 82% of the caseload in 1973 was traffic, and about 85% in 2014 is traffic. The one area in which there has been a significant change is criminal cases, crimes, misdemeanor crimes. The number of misdemeanor crimes filed in justice court is considerably less, but if you'll notice, there is a new category called other violations that didn't exist in the 1973 survey, and that's where most of those cases have gone. They're either misdemeanor cases that have been reduced to violations, or there are other violations of law, such as MIP alcohol, possession of controlled substance less than 1 ounce of marijuana, and other offenses that have been created that are violation offenses but not crimes. The justice courts and municipal courts in most of the state handle a significant part of the minor offenses, violations, and misdemeanor crimes. And we actually were kind of, in a sense, a safety valve. We provide the ability to handle these cases when either there's not sufficient prosecutorial resources to run these cases through the circuit courts, or if the circuit courts themselves are so bogged down with cases that they can't deal with them adequately. And so the Justice of the Peace and Municipal Court provide an alternative means to resolve many of these low or value and minor offense type cases that otherwise would not properly be addressed. We're essentially quality of life courts, access to justice courts. We can be in places where circuit courts can't be, and we can hold sessions when circuit courts can't hold sessions, and that's often the case. And that's one of the chief values of local courts, is we are where the people are. And in a sense, we are the original, the justice of the peace courts especially are the original people's courts. And we continue to be that. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions? Yes, Representative Leidinger, please.
Thank you for coming today. When I was in Clackamas County, we launched a justice court program, and it was an exciting, I think, important customer service, you know, enhancement for residents of the community. I would love to hear from you what you think the main needs or emerging issues are for justice courts, because they're so dynamic, and you know, you serve more rural parts of our communities. Do you have a quick couple sentences or a couple minutes on that?
Well, the immediate need for justice courts is a fee increase in our civil actions. We're we're suffering significantly. We handle a lot of small claim actions, and our fee for small claims, no matter what the value is $28 for the plaintiff to file and $28 for the defendant to file. The same actions in a circuit court, if it's $2,500 or less, is $53, and if it's over $2,500, it's $95. We handle a lot of both of those cases on both sides of that $2,500 amount. And we're asking this session of the legislature, in fact, to increase our fees. And the fee that we're seeking is it's not a break-even fee. We're asking for generally what would be about three-fourths of what the amount is charged by the circuit courts to cut the loss. In most of the justice courts, the civil filings cost the counties about $3 for every $1 in revenue that's received, and $3 or more, actually. There's some, depends upon the justice court costs are not set up the way circuit court costs are, because you have a statewide system where everybody's paid essentially the same amount. In justice courts, the counties set the compensation levels. They also basically, through their budgetary control, set the staffing levels. And so if we have a staff of three and we're used to handling X number of cases and we get X plus 500, we still only have three people to handle it. And so that's the situation a number of our justice courts are in right now, is we're getting kind of swamped with small claims because they're so cheap. And the filing fee is basically the only fee we get for handling that case.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time once again for coming by.
Mr. Chair, I want to talk a little bit about municipal courts before we leave. Most cities have a municipal court. They do that for a number of reasons. Their jurisdiction is limited to actions that occur within the corporate limits of the city. So we cannot go outside the corporate boundaries of the city. Municipal courts handle no civic actions. We do handle traffic. We handle city ordinance violations. Some cities handle criminal misdemeanors, and of course the judges can perform weddings like any other state judge in this state. All but four of the municipal judges in this state are appointed and serve at the pleasure of the council. There are four cities that have elected judges: West Linn, Hermiston, Ashland, and the city of Salem. Those are elected for either 2 or 4 year terms. The city council would appoint a vacancy to fill a vacancy should it come up in the middle of a term, but then the judge would stand for election in those four cities. In most cases, whenever possible, the judge is a member of the Oregon State Bar, an attorney trained, but there are jurisdictions where that is either very difficult or impossible to get a lawyer to serve, either because of the low pay The conflicts that such a position would place on the rest of their career, whatever it may be, or the fact that in many cities there simply isn't a practicing attorney. So there are some cities, most of them east of the mountains, where there is a lay judge that serves, and they serve, by the way, very well, and have done well and without complaint for many years. The advantages of municipal courts are, well, first of all, we're not courts of record. For the most part, there are a couple. I think Tigard is one, and there might be a couple of others that are courts of record. By that, we mean that any appeal, there is no record kept, so any appeal from a municipal court that is not a court of record goes to the circuit court and is retried from the beginning in the circuit court. And so there may be a couple of bites at the apple in that case, but there is a fairly high filing fee in that regard. And quite frankly, I've in 15, 20 years of being a municipal court judge, I've had probably two cases appealed. So in most cases, the cases are resolved at the local level without a problem. The advantages of the municipal courts, from your point of view, is there's no state funding that goes into them, but you do receive some portion of the fines that are imposed. That's set by state law. Most of the cases that we handle, if we're not there to handle them, they would go either to the justice courts, but in most cases would end up in a circuit court, taking time from their cases. In most cases, municipal courts are much more convenient to the customer, to the defendant, or to the person that's appearing in front of them, and quite frankly, also very convenient and time-saving to the law enforcement officers that appear. Most of our cases are pro se. In other words, most of the parties appear without representation, which adds an interesting dynamic to the trial level, but it really, as Judge Limhouse says, makes our courts the people's court. Many of our courts are open, have hearings or arraignments in the evening, more convenient to the local citizenry. They are, again, closer to home for everyone, and in most cases, our courts are much less expensive on a case-by-case basis than the circuit court. They're cheaper to run. Most of the judges, even in the cities in which they're elected, only serve part-time. There are a few full-time judges around the state, but most of them are part-time and will either hold other judicial positions in other cities or JP courts, as Judge Limhouse does, or have some kind of private practice to make things go. So there's, while we are city officials, we're not full-time city employees for that purpose, and that saves the city an awful lot in terms of benefits to try their cases. There have been, I just want to mention, there have been a number of cities that have either initiated a municipal court or are looking to, and for the most, in most cases, they are doing so because they want their municipal ordinance violation cases handled expeditiously and closer to home. Your nuisance violations, in some cases, your dog cases and whatever it may be are much easier and better handled at the local level than having to go 50, 100 miles or wherever to a circuit court to have those those disputes resolved in any kind of a quick manner. With that, I would open it up to questions.
I would just ask, I just happened to become curious when you were speaking. So you're public, you're hired by the cities or the courts. So do you come under the judiciary retirement system of the state?
The municipal judges do not.
Justices of the peace are general members of the PERS system. We're elected for 6-year terms just as circuit judges, but we're not part of the judicial retirement program.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for
thank
your
you.
Time once again. Appreciate you coming in. Close the informational meeting on municipal courts and justice of the peace and open a public hearing on House Bill 2361 and 2362.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, these two bills came to you from your interim judiciary committee. We're hearing them both at the same time because they both deal with guardianship and conservatorship. These are protective proceedings. And in a guardianship, one person goes to a court and says, there's another person who is unable to make their own decisions. We need to have somebody make decisions for them. Guardianships can be limited, but frequently they involve all sorts of important decisions, such as housing, daily activities, healthcare treatments, and finances. So we have two bills on this subject. House Bill 2361 says that a court cannot charge the long-term care ombudsman or Disability Rights Oregon a fee for objecting or filing a motion in a protective proceeding. These two entities are very involved in protective proceedings. House Bill 2362 says that when a court is determining whether attorney fees should be awarded, that the consideration they give the most weight to should be the benefit of the action to the protected person.
Mr. Udip.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. For those of you who aren't familiar with Disability Rights Oregon, we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization that has been designated by the governor to act as the protection and advocacy system for the state of Oregon. That designation occurred back in 1977. Governor Straub made the designation, and we've acted in this capacity ever since. It's an unusual role in that we receive federal funding in order to conduct certain advocacy activities on behalf of people with disabilities in the state of Oregon. And over the course of that work, the question of guardianships have always been prominent issues that have come before us. Because of the nature of the proceeding in which a person who has alleged to have a significant disability that affects their judgment and ability to make decisions comes before a court for a determination of whether another person should be appointed to act on behalf of that adult in making decisions about housing, placement, medical decisions, and other matters. As part of our work, we have come before you in the past and advocated for greater protections for within the hearing process and the procedural process for guardianships. As a result of that work and efforts to achieve either mandatory hearings or appointment of counsel for indigent people who might be subject to guardians and being able to achieve those particular protections, we in the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, which is a state agency, made the suggestion that perhaps our agencies could provide some greater oversight of the guardianship process when there is an individual who may be subject to a guardianship that, and the person who wants to be their guardian is proposing to place them in a long-term care facility, a nursing home, or a facility for people either with mental illness or developmental disabilities. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman was ready to step up and take that responsibility for folks who might be placed in nursing homes, and we to take that responsibility for folks who might be in mental health facilities or developmental disabilities facilities. We divided up the work because there was no resources to pay us to do the work. We volunteered to do this as part of a role that we saw as being consistent with what we did. The bill was enacted in 1999 that provided us with that role, and it requires people who are filing motions in court, either petitions for guardianships or notices of intention to place a person in a facility, that our organizations receive those notices and that's really as far as the law goes. Now, what we at Disability Rights Oregon has done over those years is we've reviewed those court filings, and in situations where it appeared that there might be a person might not understand the proceeding or be particularly vulnerable to being placed in a facility if that's not their desire, we've taken upon ourselves to contact that person, ask if they understand what the process is, if their desires are being heard, they have any concerns that need to be conveyed to the court, or if they would like a lawyer, because under law, a person can request a lawyer, although there's no money to pay for one publicly if the person's indigent. Usually, in any given year, we end up in a situation where we need to place formal information before the court in two or three circumstances. Normally, we might send a letter to the court informing them of that information. That's as far as it goes. Sometimes it's required greater action. So these aren't very frequent situations, but they do occur. Recently, we've run into a couple of instances in which court clerks have said that we will not accept your information without your filing, paying a filing fee. We felt that given the fact that we're doing the public good here, that having to pay a filing fee in order to protect that person's rights was inappropriate. And so in those cases, we felt that it was appropriate for us not to have to do that. And so that is the nature of House Bill 2361. And Chair Barker, would you like me to go on to?
Yes, please.
2362.
Yeah, I asked a question about that.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Greenlee.
Hi. It talks about either the ombudsman or a department. What department is it referring to?
I'm sorry, Representative Greenlee.
I was just trying to get it back up because I switched to look at the other one. The bill talks about, it talks about a request either by the ombudsman, the long-term ombudsman, or by, I think it refers to a department.
The system described in ORS 182.
Yeah, what is the system?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, it is confusing. The statute is written this way because many years ago, Disability Rights Oregon came to the legislature to seek parallel authority under state law as we have under federal law to investigate complaints of abuse or neglect. At the time, there was no objection to our having that authority, that mirroring authority under state law, but legislative council reported that it didn't want to place our organizational name into state law, and they came up with this particular way of doing it. So we are the system that is designated in a particular statute, and that particular statute recognizes Disability Rights Oregon's authority to investigate complaints of abuse of neglect of people with developmental or mental health disabilities.
So that's ORS 192517.
That is correct.
The one that gives you the authority. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Moving on to House Bill 2362. In the last, in the 2013 session, House Bill 2570 was enacted, which sets forth a number of factors for courts to consider when deciding whether it's appropriate to award attorney's fees to lawyers who participate in a court hearing or other actions, and if so, what the amount of those fees should be. The bill sets out 10 factors for courts to consider in deciding whether fees are appropriate and 6 additional factors to consider when deciding what the amount of attorney's fees should be. The bill specifically says that no one factor should be controlling, quote unquote. In our work in assisting people who are in these processes, we understand that it's important many times for attorneys to be involved, of course, to be involved in guardianship matters. But oftentimes the attorneys look to the resources of the protected person for those fees, and most often attorney fees award involve using the fees of that protected person to pay attorneys, not only their own attorney, but attorney for the guardian, and perhaps other attorneys that have represented other parties in proceedings. And so in order to resolve conflicts that may exist between all the parties, the resources used to do that, at least for the attorney's fees, can come from the resources of the protected person. In addition to that, because of the nature of our guardianship process, if a person for whom a guardian has been appointed is concerned about their guardian's activities, behaviors, and whether they're doing a good job, the proper step for them to take is to inform the court of that concern. There isn't a general oversight body for guardianships. And if a court receives notification that a protected person has concerns, the normal step for a court to take is to schedule a hearing in order to bring the parties together to try to resolve that dispute. As you might imagine, this poses quite a financial step for any person who is a protected person when deciding whether to bring their concerns to the court. It just happens to be the mechanism we have. And once a court hears those concerns and makes a determination, now we may very well move into the attorney fee determination process, which of course is appropriate, but in weighing the 16 factors, it's our feeling that a court should be considering the well-being and best interests of that protected person, not only, but as a consideration that has more weight than some of the other 15 factors. And that's the basis of House Bill 2362.
Hey, thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My questions are related to the second bill, 2362. Was there an observed problem that we're actually fixing? I understand what you're saying at a theoretical level, but did we see either inconsistent applications of this around the state, or judges somehow abusing it, or not acting in the interests of the protected party? You know, like, what's the problem with the status quo?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, in the variety of cases that we have seen, a number of cases in which the resources of the protected person are depleted by ongoing disputes.
Mm-hmm.
And those can be family disputes as well as disputes between the protected person and the guardian. And the sole resources that are available to pay for the involvement of the attorneys comes from that person's resources. I may have repeated myself, excuse me. While we don't challenge the importance of having a judge weigh all of these determinations, the judge is there, sees all the facts, sees all the circumstances involved, and making the call. But of course, we do have many different judges. We have many different jurisdictions, and judges, of course, particularly in smaller jurisdictions, but also larger ones, have relationships with the bar that appears before them. And so we have had individuals who have complained to us about the outcome. We're not in a position to make an objective assessment right. as to whether their complaints are valid or not.
May I follow up,
yes,
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
and forgive me, this is not intended to be hostile questioning, but I really am trying to understand. Pretend for a moment that we were trial judges. Like, what would this mean? I don't understand how it would change the thinking process that a judge would do when awarding that. I understand that there have been some complaints that have trickled up, but
Is it your feeling that judges would have made different rulings if this were in the Oregon revised statute?
Representative Barker, Representative Barton, I think that's a fair question. I don't take it as hostile at all. I think two important factors are at play, and one is that some very thoughtful people put this statute together. It has 16 factors,
mm-hmm.
and not one of which should be given the greatest weight. And I assume that a judge will follow the law as it is written. When an individual who is a protected person asks me, which of these 16 factors resulted in this large award of attorney's fees, mm-hmm. to an attorney who didn't represent me, in fact represented the guardian who I don't like, why did the judge do that? That's a difficult thing for me to answer, but I would prefer to answer it by saying, well, the judge is obligated to take your interests into account since you are the protected person. And so I'm sure the judge did that because that's what the law directs.
Okay. Wheels are still turning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. I appreciate your testimony today. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2361-2362 and open a work session on House Bill 2226.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2226 to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2226.
Is that what we discussed when we heard the bill? The Dash 1s are going to be.
Chair Barker, Brett Greenlick. This is the restitution to the estate of a victim. This bill, we talked about the Dash 1 amendments, clarified that the right of restitution passes to the estate of the person upon their death.
Thank you. I remember.
Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections to the introduction? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2226 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2226 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. And I'll carry that bill. Is there any further business to come before the committee? We stand adjourned. Thank you.